Okay, today we're going to do more about corpus linguistics, or at least building a corpus for linguistics. Last time I talked about what a corpus was and why you might want it. It's this construction, it's this object for further study, but you build it as a piece of scientific equipment itself. It's a collection of text, but it's not just any random collection of text. It's a big collection of text, and it's just not just any big collection of text, but it's one that has specific properties that make it suitable for further study and for basing an linguistic analysis on it. And it's, linguistics has been going on forever. People have been studying language and meaning and why does language mean what it does and what are the rules underlying it and so forth. But a big part of linguistics or growth area in linguistics in the last 50 years has been computational linguistics, applying computers to things that maybe because of the scale, you can do analyses that weren't possible before, and also you can answer, in some sense, questions that you might think needed complex, deep thinking about them, turn out to be, they can be answered by fairly shallow thinking over rather large amounts of data, which is what computers are ideally suited to. And a corpus is an example of that. You build up something with some work and curation, but then you can get results out of it that perhaps seem more meaningful and deeper than you'd expect given the level of information there is in the corpus. And we'll see examples of this in today's lecture, which is about once you've got a corpus, how do you annotate it with extra information? So we had information about building a corpus, and we had that corpus isn't just lots of text. You want to balance it. You want to say this is a corpus of English language text of a certain kind from plays, books, newspapers, emails, web pages, whatever. And then once you decided how to balance it between these different sources, you want to sample it. And you want to sample it somehow randomly. You don't want bias to come in because you want that corpus, however large it is, it's only ever going to be a sample of the body of text you want, of the kind of text you want to look at. And you want that it's a representative sample. You don't just want to have the first article in every newspaper because those are somehow different to the others. And so real corpora consist of things like choosing from newspapers and literally choosing random articles or taking pieces of text and saying, we'll start at a random point and then find the nearest sentence beginning and then go on for 2,000 words and then finish at the next sentence end. The Brown corpus had something like that in. So you want to say pieces of text, but somehow with some randomness, so they are sampled, and that way it's reasonable to consider them as representative of the body of work they're coming from. So balancing can go between different language types, different genres, and then, so here are some examples of corpora. So these are standard ones that have been a big part of the literature and research, and again, it's important that, for a corpus, it's important that it get reused, because then you can compare your results over this with somebody else's. If you have somebody has some hypothesis about language or how it develops or how people use it, and they test it on some existing corpus, and then you have a counter thesis, you say, oh no, the explanation for this effect is something quite different, and you do that, evaluate that on a different corpus, then you don't know whether the differences are arising because you're using a different corpus or because that genuinely you have identified some different feature that the previous person didn't know about. And so these are standard corpora that are used. The Brown corpus was one of the first, in fact, possibly the first large computerized corpus. The British National Corpus is the current kind of front runner for most used general corpus, 100 million words of text and speech in XML, annotated in various ways, and generally available to researchers. Then the Penn Tree Bank is rather smaller, but is specifically concentrating on news, and it has particular kinds of markup that can be useful. Broadcast News, Map Task, Call Home. So these are more specific corpora to do with specific tasks and activities in particular narrow vocabularies, which means that although they're much smaller, they somehow, because they're capturing a smaller area, they can be more extensive over that particular kind of language. For reasons I don't understand, I'm unable to see here what's appearing up there. How interesting. Okay, so we can build a corpus, or somebody can assemble a corpus and what's called curate it. You can you decide how big it's going to be, you decide how it's going to be balanced, how it's sampled, and then you do it and collect it. And as was mentioned for the, it's not here, but for the American National Corpus, which is being built up, it's taking years to do it. This is takes 10 or more years to build up a corpus. You decide how big it's going to be, and it takes you that amount of time to reasonably and responsibly collect the kind of text you need. But also, one of the time-consuming things is to do annotation. So you can have unannotated and annotated corpora. An unannotated corpus is just one that has a whole pile of text. Maybe you know where it came from, but that's it. So the Google Books n-gram sorter is essentially an unannotated corpus. It says, here's lots and lots of text from lots and lots of books, and you can look for word frequencies over time. You can say when a book was published. But there is no more structured information in there. An annotated corpus is much, much more useful for linguistic analysis, but it's correspondingly harder to generate. Because if you just have straight text, it's machine-readable, that's great, you've got it on a computer, but it's just a bunch of words. In fact, if it's speech, it may not even be that. It may just be a bunch of sounds. But even if it's provided as text, there are certain things to go over. So you need to do what's called, you need to pre-processing, which is just even identifying where the words are, tokenization, sentence boundaries. And then annotation, adding extra metadata that describes the text that you've got. Parts of speech, the structure, the higher level things like if it's a play, who is speaking when, how the scenes are arranged, if it's a book, the chapters, the themes, the volumes, and so forth. And here we start to get into different levels. And there's a general dichotomy that turns up in linguistics, but also programming languages and a whole bunch of other things, between syntax and semantics. This is not a new distinction. It goes back a long way to observe this. And the general idea is that syntax is about, syntax is about the words, word endings, how they fit together, the letters you use, and so forth. So it's the sort of surface structure of a language, and maybe a little bit about exactly what kind of words can go where, how they're formed into sentences, and so forth. But that's essentially about the stream of text. And semantics is the meaning. So syntax is sort of the letters, the words, maybe a bit of the grammar. And the semantics is the meaning. Semantics is what the words mean, what you understand by them. And again, that can have different kind of levels. You can have the direct meaning, but you can have deeper meanings. You can have expression to do with exactly how somebody has chosen to express a particular meaning, says further things about the writer or the context and so forth. And this is kind of a distinction between analysis of language. You can have a computer program that's good at analyzing the syntax of some text, so it takes a raw stream of text and it tells you where the verbs are, where the nouns are, where the word breaks are, how it's broken down into sentences, but tells you nothing about what the text means. And then much harder, in principle, is the task to find out, well, what does the word mean? What does the text mean? If we have a news article, we can identify that it's maybe grammatically well-formed, but what is the news article about? Is it saying a good thing or a bad thing about it, and so forth? And that's the semantics. This happens in human text. Also in programming languages, we distinguish between the syntax and the semantics. In Java or Haskell or C or ML, syntax is which characters you're allowed to put, well, what character set you can use, whether line breaks are significant, how you put inverted commas around strings, what things are keywords, what are legitimate variable names, that kind of thing. That's all syntax. And then the semantics is, well, what's going to happen when you execute this program? If you say x equals 3, the syntax is that x is going to be a variable, equals is an assignment operation, and 3 is an integer. The meaning is that 3 is a particular integer, and x is a certain variable, and that what's going to happen is assignment. So this happens in programming languages as well. We divide between syntax and semantics, as well as with human written or spoken languages. But this is not an absolute separation. Syntax covers a whole range of things from exactly the spelling of words and the arrangement of sentences to larger scale structure. And semantics includes all kinds of meaning. And there is lots and lots and lots of overlap. There are issues where, in order to understand the syntax of a language, so in order to understand, say you have a word that has multiple possible meanings, or maybe even it can be multiple parts of speech. It could be a verb or it could be a noun, depending on how it's used. So, for example, let's try here. So the word confuse is a verb, and that's kind of ambiguous. You don't need to know anything deep about its meaning. You can just keep that in a table and says confuse is a verb. So if you see it, it's a verb. The word lecture is a verb and a noun. And so from just on the syntactic side, you can't immediately tell whether it's a verb or a noun. You need to know a little bit more about the sentence in which it's appearing, the meaning of the sentence, the other words it's near. And this can go further and further. You can have various kinds of grammar or the... It can go both ways. A choice of syntax. If you have a sentence that could be expressed in one of two grammatically equivalent ways, It may affect the meaning of a whole sentence, particularly in something like poetry. And so the semantics can be affected by your choice of syntax. Use of alliteration or particular onomatopoeic effects in text can mean that ostensibly they're just changing the syntax, but actually it can change the meaning as well. And it goes the other way around, that to understand the syntax of something or what's a legitimate word or an appropriate sentence form might be affected by the meaning around it. And I mean, English has a fair separation here because the written language is quite separate from the semantics, partly because spelling and writing was fixed some time ago and the spoken language has continued to evolve. But something like Egyptian hieroglyphics or anything involving little pictograms, Japanese, Chinese, there is still some loose link between the picture that you're, or the symbol you're drawing, which is kind of syntax, which letter you chose, and the semantics, what it means. Your particular symbol does have an evocative meaning, or the choice of syntax can affect the meaning. So these do overlap. If you have a designed language, like a programming language or Esperanto, some human-created language, then often people try and enforce a more rigid separation between syntax and semantics. But that can be more or less successful. So principally, early programming languages perhaps didn't make as much distinction between syntax and semantics as we do now, and that meant that the compilers for them typically had a whole integrated stage. They could just do it monolithically. If you give a whole program, it was at the same time as it was trying to work out what the keywords were and the syntax was, it was assembling the meaning. Later programming languages make a much stricter division, so you can check the syntactic correctness of a program before you even start to try and compile it. But then there's still people to reintroduce some overlaps. The offside rule in Haskell or in Python is combining syntax and semantics, that exactly the positioning of which column you start in can affect the later meaning, and the possible meanings at this point affect which syntactic position, which columns it's legitimate to put a piece of code in. So you might willfully choose some overlap here to obtain a kind of more natural flow to it. But there's this idea of syntax and semantics, which sometimes it's useful to divide, sometimes it's useful to blur this distinction in the middle. So really at the moment, we're starting off looking at syntactic issues, and I won't do very much about semantics. Semantics are the kind of lower things like, even these are just kind of syntax. So we're interested in, we've got a stream of text, but we want to start putting some kind of annotations about the syntax on it. What's the structure inside it? First step, tokenization. This is just you've got a stream of text, and you want to divide it up into words. First approximation, a word is a continuous string of alphanumeric characters with some spaces between, ending in a space. And that's kind of reasonably good. It covers most of the cases. There are oddities. Amazon.com is actually the name of the company. Is that one word or two? It is dot, punctuation, or space. If you're at Microsoft like this, that's a single word, but it's not really alphanumeric. It's got a symbol in the middle. Possessives, abbreviations, forming a series of words into a sentence, but it's a bigger word. So obviously in German, this is absolutely the norm. It works in English as well. So this is a real sentence. The idea of a child as required yuppie possession must be motivating them. This is sort of a word. In the larger sentence, this plays the role of a single word, a single concept. But obviously, it's quite a structured thing. It contains some words inside it. So even simple things like, I want to divide this text up into words, is not always straightforward. Cul-de-sac, those are three words, but they're always kind of going to go together in English if you're using it as a single word. So it's not so much that this breaks the system, but you need to be aware that anything that says we're going to break it up into words will have to have made a choice on these. And which choice it makes, affects how further analysis. You need to be alert to this kind of thing. For spoken language, it's much, much harder, both to identify the ends of words and also, in some languages, to even know where they are. So because we are a very written culture, and you'll learn to read and write reasonably early, and even if you didn't, we're very aware of our language as relating to a written language. So things like the fact that words come separately and that sentences are sentences is very deeply ingrained in our understanding of English as a language, or typically of languages that we learn through book learning and so on. But if you have a language that is purely spoken, that has no written form at all, it's entirely possible that the speakers of that language are not especially aware of the grammar, the structure, or even the boundaries of sentences and words. So this is something that happens with anthropologists, and linguists going in and trying to create written languages for cultures that have only a spoken language. And often you do that to preserve the language. Having a written language is a way of establishing status in a community. You have a real language. You can ask the government to provide you forms in this language. You can ask for written material in it. You can write down your own culture. You can record things if you have writing. So this is something that people do. They will try and create written languages for purely spoken languages. And the first stage of this is to go and ask people, well, what words do you have in your language? And this may not work. It may be that they don't have words, they just speak. And so you have to find somebody who knows the language, maybe has learned another language, and so is aware of the idea that, posh languages like English or French have like grammar and words and so forth. And typically you might think that your own native language, which doesn't have a written form, doesn't have these. And so you have to kind of tease it out and say, well, does this language have words and sentences in the way ours does, or does it do something different? And that's the kind of thing that actually linguists do, is go around and find languages that behave differently to ours. We think languages come in, you know, sentences broken up into words, and grammar works like this, and you have verbs and adjectives and nouns and so forth. And there are some languages that don't work quite like that, and that's really interesting. So even just tokenization can be non-trivial, or your assumptions for one language may not apply or may not work for another. Sentence boundary detection, this is where sentences stop and end, and this again is somewhat nebulous, particularly for spoken language. Written language or written English is usually fairly well broken down into sentences, kind of because you've been taught to write like that. Spoken English, absolutely not. I mean, sentences will just go on and chop and change and start and stop, and it won't be quite the same at all. You can say, well, with written text, a sentence is going to be something that lots of words ending in a full stop or some other punctuation mark. And 90% of the time, that's going to be right. Some of the time, it's going to be a bit confused. Dr. Foster Went to Gloucester has... Oh, gosh, this is a cultural reference. How many people know what happened to Dr. Foster when he went to Gloucester? No! Oh, dear. Okay, he fell in a puddle. It's a sentence, right? And you can parse it. You can tell that that is one sentence, not two, even though you don't know anything about Dr. Foster and what happened to him in Gloucester. But that's because there's some kind of, actually, semantic content here. The DR is an abbreviation for doctor, and that you put a full stop after that abbreviation. You might not be quite sure why, but you sort of know you're supposed to. Actually, I'm not sure. Here, he said rubbish. This is a quote. The exclamation mark refers to the thing that's been quoted. The end of the sentence is at the full stop here. And you may or may not be uncertain about where to put the exclamation mark yourself if you're writing this. He lost cash on lastminute.com. This is particularly difficult for things that are looking for, kind of web browsers that are looking for URLs you might want to link to, because this dot is a different kind of dot to that dot. This is the end of a sentence. This is a dot inside a URL, or inside a host name. And this is something that if you have a sufficient semantic understanding of what lastminute.com is likely to be, and that that goes together to form a single word, but if you come across this 20 years ago, you would have found that rather harder to parse, and a machine will find it harder to parse, unless it knows lots of cultural and semantic information about lastminute.com and the possibility of spending cash on it. So this kind of detection is really difficult. It's impossible. It's fantastically difficult for spoken data. Even for written data, you've got to be aware of these cases. And there are two things you can do with this. You can either say, okay, we're going to cope with this. We're going to build in semantic understanding to our sentence detector. We're going to write a sentence detector that's going to catch more than 90%. It's going to go up, and it's going to do this by understanding Dr. Foster Went to Gloucester is a children's nursery rhyme. It's about Dr. Foster. It's going to understand that this is a quote and what the rules for putting punctuation on quotes is. It's going to know that lastminute.com is a website. And so you can do that. You can build in semantic information and use that to inform the syntactic structure. You start to get into a problem because typically the sort of semantic analysis you want to do would start off by saying, well, give me the words and the sentences and I'll try and work out what they mean. But we can't work out what the sentences and words are until we've got the semantic analysis. So there's a mutual dependency there, but you can begin to do it. And that, for quite some time, was the line that... where do we have this? Yeah. For quite some time was the line that research tended to go along. It said, well, the way to improve this is to give our machines better understanding of the meaning. To do it the way we think we do it, which is by understanding the sentence and then using that to help parse it, having a sort of simultaneous look at all of the levels of syntax and semantics at the same time. So what perhaps was surprising was the discovery that this is not always necessary. So the other thing you could do is, well, so we want to fix it, and that's not actually a good way to fix it. The other thing to do is, you can just stop and say 90%, that's pretty good. If we want more correctly analysed data, we'll just get more data. If we've got a big corpus, 90% of it, we've got the sentences right, well, that's fine. We'll just do some analysis that doesn't depend on it being 100% correct. And that gets you an amazingly long way. A lot of these things you think, oh, computers are no good at analysing this or understanding that. But it turns out that if you've got an algorithm that works 90% of the time, often that's good enough. For lots and lots of kinds of analysis, that's good enough. Particularly if you want to do some task like taking a newswire and analyze and picking out stories that are relevant to a particular topic. And there is absolutely no way you can afford somebody to sit reading it the whole time, pulling out stories to do with horse racing or whatever. Then an analysis that will work 90% of the time can actually be pretty good. So things like Google News, or saying what the news articles relevant to a certain topic are, or Facebook's what topics it thinks is interesting. You don't need 100% accuracy. Above some sort of level, it's okay. And in particular, you can do it much, much more cheaply than the expensive way of getting a human to look at it and work it out. So 90% of the time is often enough. And if it's not, it then turns out that to get more, you may not need to do the heavy, deep analysis you thought of semantic level. So we'll see examples of this coming up with tagging. Okay, what sort of annotation? So we've got our basic tokenization sentence boundary detection. We've got the corpus broken up into words and sentences. So we've got a little bit of structure in it, and that's good. We then want to annotate with slightly more information, and ideally information that's not explicit in the data itself, things that are beginning to move up the scale here. And that often increases its usefulness for further analysis, because we have theorem, we have hypotheses that are not just about the occurrence of particular letters or letter frequency or word frequency, but are about the structure and sentence use and so forth. Or we might want to make assertions about the particular behavior of how people write news articles compared to how they write news on the radio, for example, or on the television. And for this, you need annotations. And an annotation, you have an annotation scheme. You say what it is you're going to annotate and how you're going to do it. And typically, this consists of so-called tag sets. You're going to tag bits of the data and say, this is a something. This is a verb, or this is the subject of a sentence, or this is a good word, this is a positive sentence, this is a negative sentence, this kind of thing. Tag set is an inventory of the labels you're going to mark up the text with, and the guidelines are kind of telling you what those tags are going to mean. And originally that meant a domain expert, so you might have more than one person doing this and then more than one person using it. How are you going to use a tag set? And you want some kind of consistency. You want some idea that these tags are going to be applied in a consistent way. And yeah, so this, the origins of this are very much in having individuals go through data. The Brown corpus was done like this. Individuals go through and say, this is the sentence, here is the subject, here is the object. This sentence is a question, this is the answer that relates to that question, and so forth. And you want some kind of regularity, but this is initially just written down. It's telling people how to do the annotation and what it's supposed to mean. And the people using it can say, well, I want to do an analysis. Does this corpus have the following information? Does it have question-answer information? Does it have parts of speech? So a big part of what's happening here is parts of speech. This is the most popular, this is the common baseline annotation you want to put on some text before you can get any kind of higher analysis. The parts of speech tagging, POS tagging, is the most basic linguistic annotation. And it's the kind of thing that it's going to be essential if you're going to get meaning out of something, and it also seems that it should be reasonable to do without needing to know the meaning beforehand. So part of speech information says a particular word, it's a noun. It's maybe a singular noun, it's a common noun, it's not somebody's name, it's a name of a table, chair, whatever. You might mark that some particular word is an adjective, or it's a comparative adjective. It's saying something is greater or smaller, more or less than something. Or it's a verb, or it's a past participle, which is derived from a verb. So you might say, this is a verb, and it's being used in the past tense. That's part of speech information. Typically, it applies to a single word, but which part of speech it is might depend on the sentence around it. And one of the first things this does is distinguish between homographs. Words, confuse is always going to be a verb, so we can label that. Lecture, in some sentences, will be a verb, in some sentences, will be a noun. And so in this case, boot and boot. There's a verb boot and a noun boot. And that's part of speech tagging will distinguish between the two different forms of it. What it won't do initially, at least, is distinguish between different possible meanings of a boot as a verb. In this case, boot can mean to kick, boot can mean to boot, start up a computer. So they're both transitive verbs, and you'd need more information about meaning and context to distinguish which use you're you're using. So part of speech tagged sets, so all of the corpora that we've seen mentioned are annotated at least with parts of speech to say which kind of part of speech a particular word is. So the Brown corpus used the Brown tag set, which had 87 different tags. So that's quite a lot of parts of speech. That's more than just noun, verb, adjective, adverb. The Penn tag set used for the Penn tree bank of news articles only has 45 tags. The Clause tag set used for the British National Corpus has 62 tags. So kind of some dozens up to maybe 100 different kinds of word there. The Clause, you see this a lot in linguistics, it's called it's the Constituents Likelihood Automatic Word Tagging System. It's to do with the program that it was originally related to. But it's a particular tag set. And this is what tags look like. So an adjective, happy, bad, those are adjectives. They'll be labeled AJ0 in Clause, JJ in Brown and Penn. A noun, aircraft is a noun. It's labeled NN in Brown and Penn. NN0 in Clause, because Clause will also distinguish if we have a noun and we know that to be singular, so a book. That's a noun and it's in the singular form, and so that'll be labeled NN1. Books is a noun in the plural, so that'll be labeled NN2. So some tag sets might distinguish between singular and plural, others might not. Distinguishing between proper nouns and common nouns, so London or Michael, those are proper nouns referring to, that's why you capitalise them. So London is a noun, but it's a proper noun, and that'll be highlighted in one kind of corpus and not another. So all you can see how you can multiply up to get, well, maybe 10 or 20 tags. Getting up to 87 different tags might be quite hard work, but you can begin to see the sort of distinctions you might make. And this is sometimes is a shot in the dark, right? You have a corpus, you decide to annotate it with certain things, and you don't necessarily know which things are going to be useful for people to do analyses on, because the whole point is that later on somebody's going to have a hypothesis about the data and then want to test it. And often there's a trade-off here in that you make a hypothesis about a data set that's already there, and actually the data set doesn't have exactly the annotations you need to test your hypothesis, so you try and change it. You fix some proxy for the information you need. But this is the kind of information you want to tag data with. And so the original scheme for hand-built corpora was just to annotate them by hand. And the Brown corpus, even though that was a machine-readable corpus, it was going to go on computers and be analyzed by computers, was initially tagged by people reading through and saying, here is the noun, here is the verb, here are the adjectives, this is a plural noun, this is a proper noun, and so on. So they had to go through all. So the Brown corpus was, remember, a million words. That's quite a lot of words to go through by hand and adjust. And this idea came through, which seems slightly circular. Well, maybe we can get a machine to do the part of speech tagging. Initially, that's really, really simple. You just look up the word in the dictionary, and the dictionary says, confuse is a verb. So you said, that's the verb. Whatever sentence is around it, that's got to be the verb in there. And actually, that's surprisingly successful. There was also a scheme that just said, look it up in the dictionary. If it's unambiguous, that's the part of speech it is. If it's ambiguous, pretend it's a noun. Which initially seems kind of a bit crummy. But it turns out, no, this is up at the 90% level. So 80-90% of the annotations will be correct. Maybe you don't, and the worst thing is you don't know which the wrong ones. They're not even labeling it with don't know, they're labeling it with noun. It turns out that for some analyses, that's going to be good enough. Your data might come from a source where actually some of it is a bit scrubby anyway. So 90% correctness, if you're aware that the annotations you're using are only 90% correct, so you don't assume it's perfect, then you can get quite a long way with it. So that works surprisingly well. And it's still a separate, it kind of seems circular. If I'm using a computer to analyze it based on its parts of speech, but the parts of speech were only done by a computer guessing anyway, how do we make any progress at all? But it's still a sensible division of work. You focus on using one algorithm to generate the parts of speech and another algorithm then to do higher order analysis on it. And the problem with just looking these up in the dictionaries, you get part of speech ambiguity. Words can have several possible parts of speech, and you can get sentences where several of the words have several possible meanings. The classic example here, time flies like an arrow, where time can be a noun or a verb, flies can be a noun or a verb, and like can be a noun, a verb, or a preposition. And in fact, so the counterpart to this phrase, so time flies like an arrow, is hard to parse what the meaning of time is. So time can be a noun or a verb. And if you replace this with a sentence, fruit flies like a banana, then that's also a meaningful sentence, but it's making excessive use of the flies like words, of the ambiguity of the flies like words. So to understand what flies is, you need to understand the whole of the sentence. So this is classically given as an example where you need to have full semantic understanding to know, is this flies in the sense of time flies like an arrow or fruit flies like a banana? Well, or is like, what's the meaning of like? And so this is often given as an example why you have to have complete semantic understanding before you can get syntactic understanding. You say, well, this has 12 different possible part of speech sequences for time flies like, and you need more information to resolve ambiguities. And you'd think, so we need to understand the sentence to do that. What's perhaps surprising is that you can actually do really, 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 really well without having a higher order, an explicit high-level understanding of it. If you can use the probabilities of different parts of speech, what's the chance of a noun being followed by a verb? What's the chance of having three nouns in sequence and so on? You can get a very, very long way. So the general observation is that words can have more than one part of speech. And the first level one is saying, well, one form of a word might be more frequent than the others. You can have a word that in principle has many different possible parts of speech, but in practice only has, one is the most common. So label it with the most common one. And that gets you pretty well. That does. So take the ones that are unambiguous, label them with that. The ones that are ambiguous, pick the most common part of speech and annotate that. And that works quite well. You can then get up to much, much higher percentages by saying, well, use the sequences. Say, what's the chance of, given the last two parts of speech, words with these parts of speech, what do we have now? Noun, verb, what's going to come next? Will it be another verb or a noun? And you can say, well, it's probably going to be a noun. But there's a question, of course, of where do you get these frequencies from? Well, you analyze the data you've already got to see which kind of parts of speech sequence turn up in real text. But how do we annotate the thing in the first place? Well, maybe we had to do that by hand. So there's a sort of bootstrap procedure here, where you start with a small body of text that you have meticulously annotated by hand. You then analyze that statistically to say what kinds of sequence, noun, verb, noun, subject, verb, object, turn up in this kind of text from this kind of language. And then once you've done that, you can take another piece of text and say, I know some of the parts of speech immediately because they're unambiguous words. The rest, well, we say, we know what kind of parts of speech turn up in what places and what sequences, and we'll use that to get there. So that's called supervised learning. You end up with a system that has learnt what sort of parts of speech come in what kind of order. There's also, and that works provided you start off with some core that's well annotated. What's perhaps surprising is you can also get unsupervised learning, where you can take a bunch of text and say, you have an algorithm, so there's one called hidden Markov models, which assume that somewhere around the back, there are parts of speech, that there is a grammar to a language, and that words have particular parts of speech, like nouns and verbs. But you don't know what they are. And then, provided with a sufficiently large body of text, you can establish, or you can automatically have a machine pick up, an algorithm identify, that these words typically occupy a similar sort of position in a sentence to those other words. And so maybe they form a class of words together. And perhaps surprisingly, things like nouns, verbs, adjectives, prepositions come out of this mix. You can have an unsupervised learning machine that will run over some text and identify the structure that we know or we believe that it grammatically has. So it is possible, you don't just have to start with humans annotating it and then the machines copying that again and again. You really can have the machines discover the underlying structure and then use that to do further annotation. Provided you have large enough quantities of data, this becomes really quite effective. And so that's what gets you up into the kind of 98-99% correctness of part of speech tagging. You can have a machine run over a big piece of text and you look at it and you say, yes, those are the correct parts of speech. So here's a parts of speech tag, an automated parts of speech tagger taking a... this is just being gratuitously rude about George Bush, actually. I might try and trade it for something else. This is George Bush's quote, "Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we." So this is an amusing juxtaposition where the literal meaning of the sentence is perhaps not what was intended. But also that's expressing, so the thing here is that this is rhetoric, right? That the people listening to it probably got his message, even though when you read what it says, it means something completely different. So semantics, there are multiple levels of that too. And again, in order to have a machine understand that, you think, oh, well, we need to appreciate all the lower levels as well. So here's a parts of speech tagger. Our enemies is a plural noun. Our is a verb. Innovative is an adjective, and so on and so forth. So this is the kind of tagging we get. So We can have algorithms to do part of speech. We can do it by hand. We can have algorithms that do it automatically. But we then need to attach it to the data. And here, we use XML these days. People didn't. There are various successor languages, previous languages you'll find described. XML is now far and away the largest method used to do it. But it's an essentially technical detail. It's you want to have this metadata attached to it, and you want to know what it is. That's about it. Data is the data itself. Metadata is data about the data. And in a corpus, that might be where the corpus is from, who created it, if you're looking at a particular piece of text inside, where that text came from, and then the annotating detail. So this is from the British National Corpus XML edition, which came out a few years ago. And this is the opening sentence of a book. Now, I think... Right, so this is the... this is the wrong way around. This is the opening sentence of the novel J10. It's a completely standard example, which is why it appears here. It is used as the example for tagging in the British National Corpus. So this is a piece of XML, and as you can see, it's almost all metadata, actually. The data is the sentence inside here, which is just about visible inside the... So this is the text with it, not the things in angle brackets. Those are all annotations. This is, says chapter one, but... but, comma, said Owen, comma, where is the body? ? So that's the original text. But said Owen, where is the body? Chapter one, but said Owen, where is the body? And this is its form in the British National Corpus, which says, okay, this is a written text. It's a piece of fiction. It's divided up. Here's the first level division, and here's the opening of it. Okay, S is for sentences and W is for words. So here is a sentence, sentence number one. Here's a word. It's a noun, and so chapter it's a word, it's a noun, the head word. So the word from which it is derived is chapter. So down here we say said derives from the word say, it's a verb, and I think D maybe is intransitive. One says it's a cardinal number, and the number it is one. So this information here is kind of complete information from which you could reconstruct the text, but lots and lots of detail about it. So in this case, S is for sentences, W is for words, parts of speech. So it's using a clause code, so we have maybe dozens of these different parts of speech. C is for punctuation, so down here, this is a question mark, so it's part C rather than W. So this is a really, really detailed decomposition of the text, which seems kind of excessive labeling, but of course once you've got a machine doing it and machines reading it, it's really not that difficult to generate lots and lots of this kind of in anticipation that some analysis may need one part of it, so you might as well generate all of it. And also it means that once it's been done, that any subsequent code trying to work in it doesn't need to have really any understanding of the lower syntax level at all. It doesn't need to look at the lower level. It doesn't need to know say and said are in a certain relationship with each other. It's already in the metadata says, here we have the past tense of say. So you can do further analysis without needing to redo this kind of lower level linguistic analysis. So we've got... so we can do parts of speech, and we have this issue of we can do parts of speech by hand, we can do a small part by hand and have the computer and extend that to cover the whole document. We can maybe have the computer discover parts of speech itself. And then we move one slightly higher level, saying we've got the parts of speech, but how are the sentence broken down into a particular kind of structure? So this is referred to rather ambiguously as syntactic annotation. So we get these levels, we've broken, we've got a piece of text, we've identified the words, the sentences, we found out what part of speech each word is. We want to say, well, how do those words come together to form a sentence? What role do these things play in the sentence? I know that something is a noun, but is it the subject of the sentence or the object of a sentence? Or I know that something is a preposition, but is it working as part of some larger clause, or is it just starting with a whole sentence? Linguists use phrase markers to indicate which parts of a sentence come together. So a sentence breaks down into clauses within it. So a noun phrase refers to a noun and all its adjectives. And so we're interested in the structure that says this is an adjective and this is a noun, but is this adjective describing this noun? And here this kind of structure depends enormously on the language you're using, whether it's a language that determines the meaning of sentences by the position of the words very strongly, or the cases or tenses of words. So English is quite a positional language that by moving the words around, you can change the meaning of a sentence a lot, but the words themselves aren't particularly heavily inflected. Other languages have a lot of inflection where if you move a word around, it doesn't change the meaning of the sentence because you already know that this word refers to, this adjective applies to this noun because they match in gender or something like that. You'll move the words around more for higher level effect than to change the absolute meaning. Verb phrase, verb as its object, prepositional phrase, and the sentence altogether. And this gives you a tree. So a tree looks like, this is a sentence from the Penn Tree Bank corpus, so that's news articles number. They saw the president of the company. And even once you've done part of speech annotation, you know that saw is a verb, president and company are nouns, and they are nouns, you don't know what role they play in the sentence. But then you do this syntactic tree, which says, well, actually, this is a sentence consisting of a noun phrase and a verb phrase. Somebody did something. The noun phrase is they, the verb phrase is saw the president of the company. So we've already got the division into a structure. And then the thing that the verb phrase consists of a verb and another noun phrase, the thing that was done and to whom it was done, because this is transitive. And the noun phrase here is the president of the company, which again you have further decomposition into sub-noun phrases and so forth. So you can see this sort of layered structure. And as with part of speech annotation, you can do this by hand. The early examples, people did it by hand, merely to show that the text consistently has this kind of structure, or that a particular structural annotation form could cover the text you're interested in. But now we'll do it automatically. It can be automated through the same kind of mechanism that you can automate parts of speech. You take a body of text that somebody's done by hand, and then you have a machine that looks for similar structures in other text, nouns or particular nouns arranged in a certain way to group them into noun phrases and verb phrases. By starting with some initial text, you can train a machine on that text to do the syntactic structure of arbitrary text. And also you can have unsupervised learning. You can say, this text, these are the parts, it's annotated with the words and the parts of speech. There is some tree structure here, find it. And together, particularly trained ones, you can get to around 90% automatic tree structure. So you can have a machine go through and construct trees for all of the text, and then 90% of them will be correct. Possibly even you might have annotation that says how certain it is that an analysis might come up with two possible trees and say 70% chance is this one, 30% chance is that one. There are three possible parses for this and I don't know anything at all about which one it is. And that sometimes that's useful information to have, that a sentence can have alternative parses and that this is being aware of the quality of your data, and as long as it stays reasonably high, you can do the analysis over it. This is the same syntax tree represented in XML. This is just an informal tree. It's not an XPath tree. Here, and of course, XML is a natural for representing this kind of tree structure. When we used XML to represent just the parts of speech tagging, there wasn't a great deal of depth in it. There was words inside sentences, that was it. Whereas here, XML's tree structure, we can and will use arbitrary depth. A sentence has become arbitrarily complicated. So this is a syntax tree in XML representing the structure of the sentence. It's a sentence containing a noun phrase and a verb phrase. The verb phrase contains a noun phrase. That noun phrase itself contains a sub-noun phrase and a prepositional phrase. So the president is a noun, but it's refined by this of the company preposition phrase here. So we've got these individual words. So this is now, we've gone from something that used the XML tree structure to represent words inside sentences but didn't go to deeper levels, to something that makes real use of the tree structure to have phrases inside phrases inside phrases. And remember, there's always this trade-off in XML between whether you put something into the tree structure or you put it as annotations. So here, and this is a reasonably common choice, the parts of speech tags are attribute values. Part of speech is not a structured thing. It just says company is a noun up here. So that works as an attribute value, whereas the information that something's a noun phrase or a word is done using the element tags. The word is the whole thing. It's got a begin and an end, and the thing inside there is the word. And the noun phrase contains all of these words inside here. Also the fact that, remember, XML is an ordered tree, which matters which shards go from left to right. And when we had the gazetteer example with the country and regions, it wasn't particularly important. There was no natural ordering to the regions. It didn't matter whether the population came first or the name of the capital city. In this case, it absolutely matters because the meaning of the sentences crucially depend on the fact that, or the expression of the sentence that you extract from this, that they saw the president of the company, is indeed very dependent on the order. So here, it's useful that XML involves ordered trees. Okay, so that's all about building corpora and what we do with them, and no, building corpora and then annotating them. And next time I'm going to talk about how you can quit, once you've got such a thing, what kind of questions you might ask and how you might get information out of them. I'm finishing slightly early, but that's fine. Anyway, you have tutorials, so you can go and think about those. Ah, yes, so this was, you wrote to, the demonstrators couldn't do it, and you wrote to me. Okay, right. So, we have our problems with Galaxy, and in this case, I think I need to see, so was this with the restaurants.xq that you put a query in, or just the original blank copy?
No matter what, no, if you run the blank one, because all of the queries are commented out,
okay, but it didn't give an error message. That's good, because we have a machine on which even the blank file gives an error message. Okay. No, so for this then, I would need to see your restaurants.xq file. But that's fine, send it to me now.
Was it the Galax?
So which machine are you trying to run?
I'm using my own computer, using the SSH.
Okay, which machine are you SSHing to?
On my personal laptop.
What machine are you connecting to?
Shackleton, I think, something like this.
Okay, did you connect it by name or by, because it has a servant? So you can connect to student.ssh.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so that doesn't have Galax on because it's just a gateway machine.
Oh, and there is compute as well, which goes to Charlotte, I think.
Right, so there's a problem with Charlotte. So it runs on, it doesn't run on login.student.
Okay.
It runs on compute. It's supposed to run on compute.student, and they only put it on last night, and there's something wrong with it. So when you run it, you get an error about the Camomile database, which I don't understand.
Okay.
So I don't yet have a solution for remote SSHing. All right. You could try a machine called... so we had a test installation on a machine called a Sheep. S-H-I. Try logging into that. I don't know if you have a login. The other thing is, if you know the name of a machine in Student Labs, you can try logging into that. I don't know if they allow remote login.
But what about the rest of the DICE machines here?
The DICE machines here should be okay.
I tried 2 days ago.
Okay, so when you say it wasn't working, what happened?
It says, I went to floor 4, and it says Galax something not found. It doesn't know.
It doesn't know the problem. Okay. So on Friday, on Friday you had to reboot the machine before it would pick it up. For Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, it should have already happened. Until Friday midnight, early Saturday morning, you had to reboot the machine to pick up the updated version. So try. Yeah, I mean, I don't have every confidence in the work because we have had problems with it, but certainly it improved over Friday night, and we have had people successfully reboot the machine, and that was instruction on the log. So try again now,
see
what happens. Okay. But the remote login is, I put in a complaint about that, and I don't know how many people are collecting remote. How common and how good is the advice about remote logins?
It's very good for submitting, because...
Yes. No,
yeah.
To run this, this is why we have it.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why you need it.
Exactly.
But it's not always clear how much information you guys are given about the possibility.
Oh, none.
Right.
None.
But you must have found that something, because.
Yeah, but it was a PhD student who told me, so it wasn't really.
Okay, maybe I should write a blog post about this.
Because it's really useful.
It's really useful, but you need to be prepared to work at the terminal only, because moving up to an X login, we don't. I'm not sure many of our machines support graphical remote logins. So you need to be able to prepare to work with the text terminal, which might not be used.
Okay.
Okay, so try again is all that.